Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Alice Bryant, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will have the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is John Russell.
Thailand's government is offering a free class to Thai women who marry foreigners. The class teaches about the possible difficulties of such marriages. It also teaches how to avoid becoming a victim of scams or human trafficking when moving overseas. Thailand's Social Development Ministry said that some women believe marriage to a foreigner is a way to improve their economic situation. The government has little recent information about such marriages. A 2004 government study showed that more than 15,000 women from northeastern Isan had married foreigners. That is one of the poorest areas in Thailand. Each month, these women sent a total of 122 million baht to their families. Pachari Arayakun is the director of the ministry's Division of Gender Equality. Our course will teach women how to conduct themselves, about the laws of their destination country, and how to prepare before going, Pachari said. The class covers legal rights, how to seek help through the relevant Thai authorities, as well as exploring issues of culture shock, said Dusadi Ayuwat, a professor who helped design it. The practical advice was very useful, said one woman who attended the class. I was more interested in the legal aspects rather than the culture shock, she said. The woman did not want to give her name. Ploinisa Duongdararungrung is married to a German national. She says she thinks the education could be useful for some Thai women. Thai women, especially those from the northeast region, are soft-spoken and submissive, she said. They must learn to respect themselves and their culture. Her husband, Rolf Wacker, said the class could help prepare women for life in the West. For a lot of women, life in the West is like a fairy tale, but in reality, it can feel extremely isolating moving to a small town, he said. Wacker urged Thailand's government to offer a similar course for the foreign husbands. If the Western man does not understand the family dynamics, he said, this can cause a lot of problems. I'm John Russell.
Kristen Zaitz believes that her nuclear power plant is safe. Zaitz is an engineering manager at Diablo Canyon Power Plant, California's only working nuclear power center. She believes it is so safe that she worked there during both of her pregnancies. She has also gone diving in waters off the California coast to inspect the plant. Zaitz wears jewelry with a small piece of uranium inside, something that often leads to questions about nuclear power. In a few years, Diablo Canyon will suspend operations like many nuclear plants across the country. A combination of lower natural gas prices and efforts to cut energy waste has reduced the need for nuclear power in recent years. There have also been concerns about public safety. Worldwide, nuclear plants have been in operation for less than 60 years. Yet, there have been major environmental disasters connected to three nuclear plants: Fukushima Daiichi in Japan, Chernobyl in Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union, and Three Mile Island in the United States. In addition to the possibility of power plant accidents, critics of nuclear note that its waste can remain dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years. But supporters of nuclear, like Kristen Zaitz, say it is clean, safe, and good for the environment. And they argue that when a nuclear plant closes, not enough wind and solar power is available to replace it. They are unhappy that power companies often move to coal and natural gas, which produce environmentally harmful emissions. Together, Zaitz and her coworker, Heather Madison, a reactor operator, started a nonprofit group called Mothers for Nuclear. The group hopes to prove to Americans that nuclear power is better for the environment than some alternative energy sources. Madison says when she took the job at Diablo Canyon, she was afraid of nuclear.
And it took me 6 or 7 years to really feel like, okay, this is something good for the environment. I don't want other people to take 6 years making that decision, and we don't have that long.
Like Zaitz, Madison also wears uranium jewelry in hopes of speaking with others about nuclear energy. Nuclear is fun, she said. She said her jewelry produces less radiation than a banana. Nuclear industry experts say that women in the industry can be powerful voices for nuclear. They say these women can help influence other women about the value of nuclear energy. At the recent U.S. Women in Nuclear Conference in San Francisco, women working in the industry talked about how to demonstrate the value of nuclear power. Heather Madison says she and others think women may be the right people to do this.
As mothers, I think we also have an important role to play in letting the public know that we support nuclear for the future and for our children.
Their message is that nuclear energy is cleaner than coal or gas because it does not release heat-trapping gases into Earth's atmosphere. And that message is aimed at women. Industry experts say that women who support nuclear are seen as more believable than men. But critics of nuclear energy say it doesn't matter who is expressing support for it. Kendra Klein is a scientist with Friends of the Earth, an environmental group.
Using mothers' voices to argue for a technology that is fundamentally dangerous and that has been demonstrated by disasters like Fukushima to be not safe for the communities that surround nuclear power plants or even cities that are hundreds of miles away is disingenuous.
Still, some younger women are looking to careers in the nuclear industry. Lenka Caller works for NuScale, an Oregon business that that designs and markets small nuclear reactors.
I went into this wanting to do something good for the world, wanting to bring power to people. There's still over a billion people in the world that don't have access to electricity.
While the future of nuclear power in the United States may be unclear, the women here say they have a positive story to tell. I'm Alice Bryant.
Earth's atmosphere is in trouble. Scientists have linked rising temperatures in Earth's atmosphere to carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. When people burn coal or other fossil fuels, it releases carbon dioxide and other gases into the air, causing the planet to heat up. Most scientists warn that conditions will get worse unless something is done soon. Among those trying to find a solution is a volunteer group of scientists and farmers in the United States. The group, called the Marin Carbon Project, says it has found a proven way to slow the rise in temperatures and possibly reverse it. John Wick and his wife own the Nicasio Native Grass Ranch in Marin County, California. He helped to set up the Marin Carbon Project. Wick says the project could help save the world from climate change. He notes that when you stand in the sunshine on a nice day, it is hard to know the Earth is in trouble.
But when scientists measure it and see the effect of it and watch the ocean die off and everything happening, this was scary as hell. And then we had evidence that there might be something that could stop that. And then we had measurement of something that holds promise to actually reverse it.
What is that something he is talking about? Carbon farming. It uses processed compost to cool the earth. The compost comes from cut grass, dead plants, or other organic material which have been shown to improve the soil. Jeff Creek, an ecologist, developed a theory that processed compost can help control rising temperatures. He says what we need to do is increase the amount of carbon that agriculture captures.
Agriculture is the art of moving carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to the vegetation, to the soil, and then back again. If we can increase the rate of carbon capture and decrease the rate of carbon loss, we can actually begin to bend that Keeling curve of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in exactly the other direction, which is what we need to achieve.
Here is how Creek and Wick tested their idea. In December of 2008, they worked in a test area on Wick's ranch that had lost carbon from the soil. They covered the land with 1.25 centimeters of processed compost. This area was next to another test area without compost. Farm animals lived on both plots of land. The two men wanted to see if the compost-treated land would pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and take in carbon during photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is the process by which a green plant turns water and carbon dioxide into food when the plant is in the presence of light. Creek says putting down compost just once on the farmland provided far better results than what they had expected. He says if you use this method across 4 million hectares of cropland, large amounts of carbon dioxide would be taken from the atmosphere. The gas would end up back in the soil and be kept there. Creek explains that having the carbon dioxide in the ground would help the soil, working to produce crops and to hold on to water.
So the water implications of this, particularly for a state like California, but really across the American West and much of the arid regions of the world, increasing soil organic matter, what little bit of rain we do get, allows us to hang on to that and make better use of it.
Rancher John Wick is happy with the results of the Marin Carbon Project's experiments. He believes carbon farming could make a big difference if the method was used by many people around the world. Tom Hett works for the U.S. government's Natural Resources Conservation Service. He agrees that compost helps capture carbon in the soil and takes some carbon dioxide out of the air. But it is just one of many land management practices that NRCS advises to help both the soil and the air. Others include crop cover, less tilling or turning over the soil in between crop planting, and planting trees and smaller plants. Hett says every plot of land is different, and he says more research needs to be done to know the effectiveness of carbon farming and whether the Marin Carbons Project's findings would be true in larger areas.
It's an emerging issue. There are some people that are very excited about it. Yeah, there's dangers in taking a few plots and just kind of doing the math. The multiplication is pretty easy, but the site-by-site prescriptions are much more complicated than that.
He says the findings show enough promise that last year, 4-year-long field trials were started on a number of range and grasslands throughout California. The 14 trials will run to test the use of compost for carbon farming on different kinds of lands. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Woodrow Wilson. He served 2 terms, from 1913 to 1921, and led the United States through the First World War. Wilson might have seemed an unlikely war president. He was a university professor before he entered politics. And when the conflict began in Europe in 1914, Wilson strongly rejected the idea of the U.S. getting involved. He even campaigned for his second term on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But Wilson's idealism eventually made him believe the U.S. must enter the conflict. He famously said, "The world must be safe for democracy." He spent the last months of his presidency fighting to create a League of Nations that would prevent future wars. Wilson did not succeed in that effort, but the effects of his presidency are still seen today in both the domestic and foreign affairs of the United States. Woodrow Wilson was born in the state of Virginia in 1856 and grew up in the South. Wilson's father was a Protestant Christian minister who supported the views of the Confederacy during the Civil War. Wilson's mother had been born in England, but raised in the United States. She was reportedly warm and loving, especially to her husband and four children. Wilson's early life was marked by poor health and a passion for learning. His education included tutoring by Confederate soldiers, classes with his father, a year at Davidson College, a bachelor's degree from the school now called Princeton, 1 year of law school, and a doctoral degree in history and political science from the University of Johns Hopkins. He remains, so far, the only president with a Ph.D. Wilson's academic interests were in government and how it could be most effective. Even as a young man, he supported the idea of a strong executive, either a prime minister or a president. He wrote a number of books, including a biography of George Washington and a history of the United States. He also taught popular classes at several colleges, including Bryn Mawr in Pennsylvania, Wesleyan in Connecticut, and Princeton in New Jersey. In time, Wilson became the president of Princeton. He made major reforms to the school until some faculty and alumni resisted his efforts. Wilson had always been interested in political power. The Democratic Party in New Jersey became interested in Wilson when they were looking for a candidate with an honest public image. In truth, party officials believed he would be a weak leader whom they could influence. Wilson surprised them by winning the seat as New Jersey governor easily and then rejecting their efforts to control him. He went on to pass major reform legislation in New Jersey that reduced corruption and protected the rights of workers. His actions drew the attention of Democratic Party leaders seeking a candidate for president in 1912. Voters did not overwhelmingly choose Wilson in 1912. Although he did well in the Electoral College, he earned only a little more than 40% of the popular vote. Other votes were mostly divided between two former presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and William Taft. Yet, Wilson quickly asserted authority over Congress and pushed through a number of laws aimed at dramatic reform. Historian Kendrick Clements at the University of South Carolina says, Wilson had a strongly progressive vision. He was interested in expanding economic opportunity for people at the bottom of society and eliminating special privileges enjoyed by the richest and most powerful members of society. One of Wilson's most important acts was to create a new federal agency called the Federal Reserve Board. It still regulates American banks, credit, and money supply. He also created the Federal Trade Commission to ensure fair business practices and the Department of Labor to protect workers' rights. And he supported laws to reduce working hours for railroad employees, bar child labor, and offer government loans to farmers. But even during Wilson's busy lawmaking, the threat of World War demanded his attention. Wilson had declared that the U.S. would remain neutral in the growing conflict between the Allied and Central Powers. One of his reasons was that people in the U.S. were immigrants from the countries that were at war. Wilson did not want the conflict to divide Americans. However, he permitted international trade, including with Britain and France. As a result, many believed the U.S. was favoring those countries. In 1915, a German submarine sank a British ship called the Lusitania and killed more than 100 Americans on board. Wilson protested several times to Germany about the sinking. He warned that the U.S. would not accept another such aggression. But 2 years later, Germany attacked U.S. commercial ships. It also invited Mexico to enter into an alliance against the United States. At the beginning of Wilson's second term in office, he asked Congress to declare war on Germany. The U.S. entered World War I on the side of the Allied powers. The additional support came at an important time. American soldiers were able to help resist German troops in France. In time, Germany asked for an armistice, an agreement to stop fighting. Following the war, Wilson had a grand vision for how to gain lasting peace in Europe. He proposed that the countries that had won the war not punish Germany. Wilson also wanted European colonies to rule themselves and other areas be given immediate independence. Most importantly, Wilson suggested a League of Nations that would guarantee the member countries independence and safety. But few world leaders agreed with his plan completely. Even in the U.S., many Republican lawmakers in Congress resisted Wilson's idea for a League of Nations. Some strongly objected to any treaty that would limit the country's independence. Others did not want the country to be involved in world issues at all. So Wilson began a trip across the U.S. to raise public support for the League of Nations. He traveled more than 15,000 kilometers in 22 days and gave 29 speeches. Wilson's doctors warned him that the trip was hard on his health, but Wilson was firm about pressuring Senate Republicans to adopt the agreement. Finally, he collapsed from exhaustion. Shortly after, he suffered a major stroke. Although he recovered somewhat, he remained partly paralyzed. He rarely appeared in public again. Instead, Wilson communicated to Congress through his wife. When Republicans changed the treaty to deal with their concerns, Wilson told his supporters to reject it. In the end, the U.S. never did join the League of Nations. When a new president, Warren Harding, was sworn in 1921, Edith and Woodrow Wilson retired to a house in Washington, D.C. 3 years later, the former president died quietly there, finally at peace. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.